What is family? A story from long ago. I've been visiting a family this week on the other side of Aberdeen. It's a long story. Where the very elderly lady who has just died was married for more than 50 years to a gentleman who, in wartime years, shared a German prisoner of war camp with Douglas Bader, the famous reach for the sky, RAF, legless hero who kept escaping from those same camps and being caught. The lady who has just died came from a family of 11 children. Her late husband came from a family of 11 children. I get the idea that at Christmas, and especially at Hogmanay, theirs was a family get-together to beat all family get-togethers. But it invites the question, what is a family? Sometimes a union driven apart by war and circumstance. Sometimes a rich, laughter-filled gathering of siblings, children, grandchildren, and a thousand stories. The story we shared this morning, the first in our biblical soap operas, comes from the book of Ruth, and it is a story about family. Driven from one country to another by famine, then made more weak and vulnerable by the death of their menfolk, then finding shelter and protection and ultimately love and security by traveling once again. But always the risks were high, because often they were strangers in a strange land. Today, we would call them refugees, but they were also family. And theirs is a story of family from long ago. More than 1,300 years before the birth of Christ, when Israel is still a country in the making, there are regular wars and skirmishes between the Israelites as they try to settle into what they believe to be their promised land, and the native tribes, who are understandably less than impressed by the incomers. There are outbreaks of peace, fragile but precious, and everyone in this troubled, volatile, frequently bloody landscape depends on the land to feed them, so famine is a nightmare. And it is famine which forces an Israelite couple with two sons to leave Bethlehem and seek food in a foreign country. The country is Moab. The mother of the family is Naomi. And I should have remembered the name. They arrive in Moab as outsiders, living always under the gaze of suspicion. But they do find food and security of a kind. And 10 years pass. During that time, their sons marry local Moabite women. But then both sons die, as does the father. That means, if you can get this, there's a family of three widows. The mother, Naomi, who is an Israelite, and her daughters-in-law, Ruth and Orpah, who are Moabites. A rumor spreads that there is a good harvest coming in Israel. So Naomi decides to return to her country, to Israel. But her daughter-in-laws are not Israelites, and they are widows to boot. This will not endear them to the Bethlehem locals. So Naomi insists that they, the daughters-in-law, stay in Moab, where they will at least find some degree of protection through their native family from their own blood. Orpah agrees, but Ruth insists on traveling with her mother-in-law. For the sake of love, for the sake of family, she's determined to go where her mother-in-law goes. Thus the beautiful verses that Isabel read. Don't ask me to leave you, says Ruth. Let me go with you. Wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you will live, I will live. Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God. That is a powerful declaration of allegiance. So Naomi and Ruth return to Bethlehem. Naomi is a widow. Her daughter-in-law, Ruth, is in a worse social status, widow and foreigner and childless. Begging for scraps, as refugees often do, Ruth is gleaning a field, picking up what's been left by the harvesters. which by chance that field is owned by a relative of our late mother-in-law's husband. Yes, and his name is Boaz. Don't try to follow the details too much, just go with the flow, okay? This is a simplified version. He seems to be a good man, this Boaz, a man whose wealth has not made him immune to the poverty of others. And that is partly the curse of wealth. Whatever its blessings, its curses, it sometimes makes people immune to the suffering of others. And Boaz offers Ruth his protection, telling her what fields to work in and assuring her that his men have been given orders not to molest her. Then, as now, refugees can be seen as fair game for the locals to have fun with. Remember that incident in Germany last year, last New Year's Eve, when hundreds of sexual assaults were carried out on immigrants, refugees who'd come in? The thing we need to remember in the culture Ruth and her mother-in-law find themselves in, they are women without husbands. Their status and their security is zilch. It is worse for Ruth because she's a foreigner, because she's a young woman, and that makes her more of a target for any man with a dark agenda. But under Boaz's protection, she and her mother-in-law begin to prosper. And eventually Boaz marries Ruth, a decision approved by the men of the village, and the deal is sealed, with Boaz buying the field that originally belonged to Naomi's late husband. And guess what? And this is a deal breaker. If you buy the field, you get Ruth thrown in for free. Even Asda haven't gone that far. Boaz buys the field and marries Ruth. To our 21st century ears, it sounds as if the woman is little more than an object, a sweetener to make the deal a bit more attractive. It can all sound desperately insulting to us, but in its cultural context, this is a story of a rich man exercising social care and protection to a refugee far beyond anything that society expected of him. It's a story of two women, Naomi and Ruth, using their wits in a society where customs and traditions and inheritance laws are all stacked against them. It's particularly the story of a young woman called Ruth, who is a foreigner, who is a refugee, who is a widow. But, and this is the story's driving narrative, Ruth has a powerful, culture-transcending sense of family. And so her future is interwoven with her mother-in-law's future. All this is happening in the days of the judges, the years before Israel had the relative stability of kings. It's an age where skirmishes and bloody battles are commonplace, an age where a woman without a man was vulnerable, and a woman without a son was to be pitied. So you could say, in some countries in this world of ours nowadays, you could say that we've moved on, that the status of women now is different and higher and equal. But there are many other countries where the status of women remains derisory and fragile and patronized. And suddenly I'm not sure whether we're talking about Donald Trump or whether we're talking about brutal, poverty-stricken parts of the world. But you get the picture. So Ruth is a story of cultural norms being challenged. Ruth refuses to return to her native people. Instead, she commits to her family, even though that commitment will make her a stranger in a strange land. And Boaz, the landowner, refuses to abuse the undoubted power he has as a wealthy landowner. And in the final verses of this story, which Isabel wasn't able to read, this story of a family from long ago, we're told that Ruth gives birth to a son. And the son, in time, proves to be the grandfather of King David. And from King David's line, many centuries later, there is another birth in Bethlehem, one Jesus, who in the years immediately following his birth also lives as a refugee, for a while in Egypt. How much of the Ruth story is true? How much is fabrication? I don't know. And on this occasion, actually, it doesn't matter. The story is in Scripture to challenge our notion of family. It is actually suggesting that loyalty to native country, loyalty even to inherited religion, can be transcended by loyalty and love to one's family. That is something surely that Bernardo's know a lot about, the power of family love to transcend and transform broken historical legacies and to heal historical hurts. Ruth may be a biblical soap opera, but it's also a story of hope and courage. And Bernardo's know all about hope and courage.